stopped last time, and it was basically the authentication service with Kerberos. Originally, it was developed in the around the mid 90s, around at MIT as part of the Athena project, which consisted of a huge number of workstations and PC network together, and they basically looked for a way to avoid to install login files or password files on every individual machine, basically to arrange it as a service environment. And thus they developed authentication protocol, and the goal is here that you have, when we look at the motivation of it, that basically you would have clients, you would have servers here, if you look at these ones, and you have the possibility that they can authenticate each other in a sense that the server is certain that the component it is communicating with, that's really the client, and on the other hand, the client is certain that it's interacting with the server. In the same way, if you think of an individual person, if you do want to do some bank online banking, you as a client, you want to be sure that this is really the bank website you interact with and not really a fake website. That's what the phishing activities basically do. They pretend to be the bank site, and you provide your secure and private information, and then they can basically use it to interact with a real website. On the other hand, the bank wants to make sure that it's interacting with a real client who is who has an account with them. The Kerberos here, we have four components, as I mentioned, client and server. And additionally, we have something like a key distribution center and a ticket granting service. The key distribution center, it's basically the highly secure entity which authenticates a client and to find out if it's really the client or not. And the ticket granting service, that's basically the entity which provides session keys for the interaction between the client and the server. The intention why these two entities are separated, because the key distribution center basically uses some of the private information of the client in the sense of password. And therefore, in you do the authentication at the beginning, and usually a client interacts with many services, and therefore the authentication is done once at the beginning, and then with the ticket granting service, that basically provides for all the involved services the session keys. And the point is here, the password, if it's used, or password information is used only once, and it's not really used for for granting session keys anymore, and therefore it's used very seldom, actually. The goal we have here is the, as I mentioned, KeyDC manages the secret keys. If you use a person, that would be basically the password. And usually also KeyDC is physically very secure, in a very secure area, in a sense that you lock it up and nobody has access to it. And with session keys, the TGS basically provides these session keys, and these session keys have only a limited validity, and that's basically then used for the interaction between the client and the server. And if you want to have a new session, then basically you need a new session key. The security objects, what we have here is a TGS ticket that's issued at the beginning with a key distribution center, and that's usually has a limited time validity, as you hear, limited time, but we talk here about 8 hours. And that's the TGS creates session keys. The session keys are usually only for one session with the server, basically exchanging request-response. If you have a new request-response round, basically you need a new session key. And that session key is generated by TGS. And in order to get a session key created by TGS, you have to submit the TGS ticket. And the authentifier, that's then generated by the client basically to exchange with the server. And usually it's, most of the time, it's something what it's called a nonce, or very often it's basically just a timestamp, what is exchanged. And the expectation is that the correct timestamp comes back from the server, and if it comes, then the client is sure that it interacts with the right server. The when we look at it, the security objects we already have, and now we can look at the authentication process. The point is here, it's only a rough overview. And if you want to hear more about security, computer cryptography, and so on, then basically you have to go into the computer privacy or computer security courses by Eckert or by Prechner. And if we look at here, what we have is here, the client, it wants to interact with the server. It starts, first it needs from Kerberos, here from KDC, a TGS ticket. And therefore it sends a request, it gets a TGS ticket, and this I mentioned, it's separated. Therefore, if this is compromised, then this is uncompromised, or if that's compromised, then basically this is usually a very secure area, and it's a very separated component. TGS ticket, the client presents the TGS ticket and says, well, I want to interact with the server S. It gets a server ticket, and then it both exchange the authentifier, and then they communicate via a secure channel. And we can actually look here, and also if we have multiple sessions, also here multiple sessions with S, then you have several session keys. Therefore, it's not something like you get a key with a server S for each session, and it could be that a TCP session, in the sense of sending a request and then exchanging a few data and then closing the session, then basically the next time you need another session key from TGS. We can look at exchanged messages from C to Cardi C. Here at the beginning, the client sends basically who it is, and it wants to interact with the with TGS. Then KDC has a secret key of C. In that sense, if we talk about a person, then that could be basically the password of the person stored by KDC. And KDC also generates a session key. And this is a session key now for interacting between C and TGS. And it's, let's say, a good random. Good means in a sense that it cannot be broken easily by an external intruder. And that's now sent from KDC as an answer to C. And what we have here is the session key. As we hear, session key with TGS, you can't send it in plain. You have to encrypt it by the key, which is only known to the client. And it's also known to KDC. But it's not supposed to be known by anybody else. And additionally, we have a ticket. And this ticket, that's encrypted by the private key, or by the personal key of TGS. Therefore, in that sense, this ticket can only be read by TGS and not by anybody else. It's something like here C receives it, but it's something like in an envelope. And it's comparable as if you get a reference for a stipend, and that's sealed in an envelope, and you can't open it because there's a stamp in the back on it, and if you break it open, then everybody sees that it's broken. And here, this ticket, what it includes, it's also the session key, which gets C. Because they have to interact with, therefore they need the same session key. Additionally, it gets the information that it's supposedly interacting with C. And here there's TGS, that's the receiver of the ticket, and also it gets the timestamp in it, when it was created, and also the lifespan of the ticket. Usually the lifespan, I said, it can be arranged by the system administrator. It's usually a longer time that it's valid, and we talk here about 8 hours. And that ticket, both information is now received by the client. It has it now available, and now it wants to request a session key or a ticket for the server. And therefore it sends to TGS the following information, like here his own information that it's C and a timestamp, and it encrypts it already with the new session key it received by KDC. Then it submits the ticket from which it received from KDC. As we hear, ticket from KDC, and also in plain form that it wants to interact with a server. What does the TGS, it checks if it's valid. And therefore, if the ticket includes here the C, and also the request, which is also here, it's encrypted by the session key, it also includes C. Therefore, this must match. Also, the ticket includes here this information, KCTGS. This is necessary in order to decrypt that information. If that's not conform, basically this information can't be decrypted. And if that can't be decrypted, then basically something is wrong and the interaction does not continue. Here also, what it checks, if this is still current, and here we talk about a much shorter time frame. Then the next, when this here, when everything matches, and when it's still current, then basically TGS creates a session key. And that session key is now submitted to C. Here, that's here the session key for the interaction between C and S. It's encrypted with the session key between C and TGS, and C get a new ticket, and that ticket is supposed to be presented as here only readable by S. And it also includes here C, S, then also a timestamp when it was created, the ticket, and also here a duration time, which is a lot shorter than the 8 hours of a TGS ticket. And, well, it could be limited in the area of minutes or something like that. And here, again, we have the same session key which is in here. And that's the way how to exchange session keys over, let's say, public lines. And therefore, in that sense, you need the encryption of using secure encryption techniques. And now the next step would be that C would basically interact with S. It sends certainly the ticket, and that ticket can be read by the server. What it does, it checks if C here and C here matches. Here it also includes, this also includes the KCS, that's basically this here, and that's it uses to decrypt that part. And now it checks if TC is valid, if that's still a time, if it's a replay, or therefore in that sense it checks if it's still valid. And now comes the next thing, that if this information is sent back, that's basically the TC from the previous message. And therefore in that sense, C is here certain that it actually used the TC it had in its message already included in an encrypted form. And it could be that it's somewhat a variation of it. Sometimes they put a code on, or put an algorithm on it to modify TC in a well-known way, where it comes, where it's visible that actually the original TC, which was sent here, was used as an input for that here, and that's supposedly where C is then certain that it interacts with the correct S, and. And this here is usually called a nonce. The An example, we can also look at a user login in Kerberos. That's also done with using KDC. And the interesting part of it is that there's no exchange of the user password. And very often, if you think of it like when you log in a server, that very often the password is sent either plain or they use this base 64 that it's shifted just to the left or right. And if you just apply the reverse shift, then you get the plain password ID. And that's not the case here. The password is not exchanged across the network. And as we will see here, you are sitting at the workstation. You send your username to KDC. The KDC basically searches in its login database for your password. And therefore, you have to be a registered user. And then it creates a session key. And this session key is then encrypted with a password. Therefore, you apply an encryption algorithm on it. And a symmetric encryption technique, but using as a key your password. And therefore, in that sense, it also creates this TGS ticket, which you need later for interacting with the TGS to get server tickets. And now, you as a user, you get this session key, and now that's the point here. The user workstation receives now TGS and the session key. And now the user is asked on its local workstation to type in the password. And that password is then used to decrypt the session key. And when the password is correct, then basically the session key can be decrypted correctly. And the password can immediately be removed from main memory. Therefore, you need it only to decrypt the session key. And the session key is then stored for further communication. And the password basically is used only once, and it's not exchanged across the network, used only for one decryption process, and then after that, the session key is used for the further interaction with TGS and so on. And in that sense, the use of the password is rather conservative. And also, it's removed from main memory that nobody can attack and try to read and make a log from main memory layouts and information of it. And then afterwards, it basically continues with TGS and server tickets from the ticket granting service. And it was developed as part of Kerberos of Athena, and also if you look at Windows, the newer Windows version, they basically also use a variation of Kerberos for authentication and for interaction with in a secure way with components. Good, that's so much for that. And the next thing we would look at is web services. And the point is, if you think of the web, then usually you have an interaction human-machine, and the interpretation is done by a human. Here, if you look at web services, you would have an application communication. And that means the documents, the web documents, have to be interpreted by the individual application. And therefore, they can't have any ambiguity in it. They have to be a rather strict format, a rather strict representation that applications can really correctly interpret it in a way that they don't have a random randomness in the whole thing in it. The whole thing was standardized by the W3C community, and the point was here, when we look at the motivating example, that you have usually in the way from the tab, from the web, you have browser names, request, reply, HTML, HTTP. You want to generalize the model and also have the same way of interaction, but now you have here applications behind it, and you have a client application behind it, and then you can do an interpretation possibly by the user. But here you have an interpretation by the machine, by an application. And the point of it is here that it's not only restricted to arrangement. Also, you can have a multi-tier architecture in a way that you might have here other web services behind it. Therefore, you can have a whole hierarchy of multi-tier interaction. And in a way that you can also have, can combine, as we will later see, this web service interaction with the distributed transaction mechanism. And there's part of the standard of web services, then you can, in the same way, and when we talked about the server interaction, that we said, well, requests and responses, when multiple requests we can put under the boundary of a transaction. In the same way, I can do that with web services, and that's especially interesting if you think of, certainly if you have here a flight reservation, and well, there is a dependency. You get a hotel, but not a flight. You get a flight, but not a hotel. Therefore, you have to arrange it that basically they have to fit to together. Therefore, you can put it on the distributed transaction mode. The point is here, web services grew out of the service-oriented architecture. And service-oriented architecture, it was developed in the mid-1990s. And the goal was to have something like a loose coupling and the dynamic binding of services, and the focus of what you had were here on business processes. And if we looked at it before, then the focus, when we looked at RPC, the focus there was on a technical or technology interface. that we looked at, well, what parameters do we send back and forth? What's the name of the procedure? What's the name of, or what kind of results get I back? But it was a purely technical interface. Here, the focus was on the business processes. And therefore, it was then derived, what kind of technology do I need to implement these distributed business processes? And the goal here was to arrange here the services across the network, and therefore, certainly you had a similar start. You had something like a provider, you had a client, well, we know that with the client-server architecture, and then additionally what they had here is the service registry. Sometimes they also called it broker, and the goal was here to publish things and then for the client to find it. And also here service provider, service requester. And the intention here was that the service did not depend on the state of another service. Therefore, in that sense, it had an autonomous behavior. And if we had the service provider needed information about the service requester or the reverse, you had a data exchange, as a year data exchange via messages. And that was basically then the way that two entities could interact with and could depend on. But usually if you looked at client-server architecture on the basis of on RPCs, then very often an RPC call, they stored local data about the client. And here it was more or less that here it did not depend on the state of the service requester and the interaction. It manages their own data, and coarse granularity. Therefore, in that sense, we had a collection of objects. And if you think of RMI, well, the interaction is on the object level. Here, the interaction is on a component level, and the component consists of many objects. And therefore, in that sense, you have a much larger level. And the communication, certainly, between it's on messages, and the focus is on the design, on the service interface. And if we think of it on SOA and component-based architecture, because, well, I already mentioned here, these are heavyweight services. And therefore, you could think of, well, isn't it the same as component-based architecture? There are slight differences. Component-based, you have a tight integration. If you have enterprise Java Beans as a component, here, SOA, you have usually a loose integration. Component-based code integration, code-oriented, you divide up your source code and distribute it across the network. Here, it's more a process-oriented view, in the sense of you think of process steps and process functionality and divide it up by process functionality. Here, the goal was to handle the technical complexity. Here, you handle the complexity of businesses and you want to provide interoperable architecture for businesses. And the goal is here for component-based build to last, because you try to build a distributed application and supposedly it should work because you have this tight integration. Here you build everything via services, and these services come and go and can be replaced very easily because of the loose coupling, so due to loose coupling. And therefore there are a slightly different focus what we have here. And if we think of the layered approach, then services here, that's on the service layer. And services allow you a very easy access to objects. And objects can be bundled together to components. And on the other hand, you can have multiple services which interact with a variety of components or individual objects via the component layer. We can even have something like composite services. Here, a composite service which consists out of sub-services, and the services can here again interact with multiple objects on different machines. And the origin is here, you have these business processes. I mean, these are the business processes. And here you have applications. What kind of applications could you have? Like an application, human resource application. Or another possibility would be product portfolio. Therefore, you already see where the orientation from SOA actually comes from these business processes, and therefore, in that sense, the applications are pretty much business-oriented and not really coming from the technology as you had it from the client-server architecture. And the point is, it's not that SOA or services are a completely different approach as client-server applications. Certainly for the interaction here, you use client-server interaction between here the services and the objects, or the service and the other service. Therefore, in that sense, you use the technology, but you provide a different perspective to the people you want to sell that idea. And when you think of adopting the SOA architecture, then in that sense, the idea was to have interoperable network applications. Therefore, you can have it in a large intranet, or you could even use network applications or services from other companies. You allow an easier exchange of data, then provide an easier access of enterprise-wide data, because now the interface is not really tightly coupled, it's very loosely coupled. You also can include external services, like simple things, like weather forecasts. You can include that from a weather channel. And for example, if you have a company which basically tries to handle like agricultural things, and when should certain things be brought out on a field and so on, and now you can really bundle that with a weather forecast from a weather channel and provide some more application to your customers. And therefore, in that sense, that was not so easy before, because the way how the technology interfaces looked, the RPC port was usually closed, you couldn't interact with, and so on. And now with these network services, it's much easier. Cross-organizational computing, if you think of car manufacturers, then service suppliers, and if you think of certain service suppliers, they are actually much larger than the car manufacturers, and there are a number of these suppliers which interact or which are supply different car manufacturers, and usually they have to provide it in a way that it's not a generic thing, like Bosch, if they provide something for Daimler or if they provide it for BMW, well, it's usually not the same thing. It's differently, specifically targeted to a specific car manufacturer. And that means the supplier is integrated into the intranet of BMW and integrated into the intranet of Daimler. And you want to avoid that now BMW can, via Daimler, get into the secrets of, that they can get into the secrets. And therefore, in that sense, cross-organizational computing is interesting, but also you have to have a lot of security and privacy issues involved with it. Reduced maintenance cost is, should be one effect, and here, small, the intention is that you have small effects on existing infrastructure. Restraining issues, different formats, different semantics of data, if you use that, because data is not a way. We already heard about data in a sense of data representation. You have to find the correct data representation, and security issues, that's already, I mentioned here, that's a really major things. And one of the things, what is important here is the enterprise service bus, that basically what you have is here in the same way as you have, you think of Ethernet, that you say, well, I have here all my services. They are on the bus, and here also some, then I might have some clients, and these clients basically here might have my service bus, and here I can have here the interaction with all the different services. And this service bus can be here actually my, that can be the intranet, or it can be the internet here in between. And there exists an open source approach with Mule, but there exists also a proprietary approach, for example, by IBM, and they provide here with this middleware, that's a messaging middleware, things like support for XML, for web services interfaces, and also here a rule-based routing of documents, routing in a way, is it itinerary routing in a sense that you have a schedule, or you have something like a content-based in the message stands who gets the message next, or we stop And or basically you can also have it event-based. Next, tomorrow we will continue with web services. Web services basically an implementation of SOA with web technology. And it's nothing else. It's not a competitor. It's basically just using SOA approach and using here web technology. Okay, let's stop here. Then we'll